It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. I want to ask you, honestly, did you buy that last bottle of wine because the label matches the dishes? Now, don't feel bad. I think we're victims of these supposed wine experts who say to learn about wine, we have to keep trying different ones until we find what we like. Well, somewhere around random bottle number 4 that you hate, you throw up your hands, the credit card, and your disappointment level can't take it anymore. We who don't live and breathe wine, well, we need the Cliff Notes, exactly what to taste and how to do it. And that's where the fun begins. Well, today, it's real-world wine advice, your calls, and much more on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. You know, with everything that's going on in the world and the fact that winter seems to never end, I've been thinking about optimism. You know those live and hope moments? For instance, those moments when you walk into a restaurant like a kid on Christmas morning, you're just so set up for a great experience, for a great meal, another adventure. And then about an hour and a half later, you walk out like the kid whose only gift was white cotton underwear. Well, Jane and Michael Stern have dedicated their lives to saving us from those moments. They check out hometown eating across the country, and they report their finds on their road food site and here. Jane, Michael, welcome.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
So guys, from whence have you come? What's the most recent trip?
We have been in Buffalo, New York. And, you know, if you ask most people, what is Buffalo famous for, food-wise, they would say buffalo chicken wings, of course.
Right.
Or they might say beef on weck, those wonderful freshly sliced roast beef sandwiches on rolls spangled with coarse salt and caraway seeds. Both of those are great. But one of the things we appreciated fully on this last visit was that Buffalo is probably the best city in the United States for having hot fudge sundaes and chocolate candies.
You're kidding.
No, specifically sponge candy.
Oh,
do you
yeah.
know what that is, Lynn?
Is that the stuff that's like a honeycomb in the center?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that center, that crisp honeycomb center, just kind of becomes a halo for the chocolate that enrobes it. And what's so great about the stuff in Buffalo is that the chocolate there is real, made from cocoa butter. I mean, it's like really dense, deep, dark chocolate. There are probably a dozen different places in town that make their own, ranging from little tiny mom-and-pop stores to, like, fairly big candy makers. But they're all, like, really into making first-class chocolate.
I think the best ones we ate were at a place called Alithia's, which is half an ice cream parlor and half one of the most gorgeous candy shops I have ever seen. I don't want to say high-end candy, but it is probably as good as any fancy schmancy stuff you would ever find. The owner of the place, Dean Tassie, took us on a little expedition in the back of the store where they were actually making sponge candy. And it is so interesting to see it made because into this giant vat of caramelized sugar is poured baking soda. And it's stirred and it's stirred until it rises like this gigantic puff.
Well, they leave it overnight to rise. And he said the secret of great sponge candy, of Buffalo's great sponge candy, is that like a half of it, the outside is all cut away, leaving the tenderest, lightest, most fragile part in the center. And that's what they use for these candies.
I'll take the scraps.
You can get the scraps. They sell bags of what's called naked sponge, which is the inside without the chocolate around it.
But can I just say that Jane almost just happened to mention the fact that this is also an ice cream parlor. And let me tell you, if you like sundaes, turtle sundaes, banana splits, partly because the sauce they make is so wonderful. I mean, imagine the hot fudge a place like this makes. Marshmallow, they don't melt marshmallows. They make that from scratch, too. And best of all, if you get a sundae that demands nuts on top, like a tin roof, for example,
right,
or a turtle sundae with walnuts, These are not the kind of soft, mealy nuts you tend to get in other ice cream parlors.
Yeah, and they're usually stale and all of that rancid.
No, these are crunchy, crisp, and salted just enough to make all the sweet things below even more intense.
I have to say, I mean, the sponge candy sounds wonderful. But to me, a great hot fudge marshmallow sundae, mm-hmm. that is worth a pilgrimage.
With
on your knees, if need be.
Yeah. Well, we'd probably work off some calories if we traveled on our knees. But anyway,
guys, this is a jewel. Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me. But when we're driving in my Malibu.
Gene and Michael Stern are authors of 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can find the Sterns' road food finds anytime. Just go to the trusty website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our weeknight kitchen e-newsletter, the show podcast, our special recipe collection of cheap eats, and also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. On the show, we like to pick maybe one recipe that is intimidating to some, and then go to an expert to get their take on the how-to. Well, right now, after the showstopper dishes of the holiday, I still like to get people oohing and aahing at the table. So soufflés are on the short list of those dishes. And by the way, there's a dirty little secret. Soufflés are cheap. Well, our expert is Chef Patrice Olivon. Now, you may have seen him on Iron Chef. He's Program Director of Culinary Arts at L'Académie de Cuisine in Maryland. Patrice, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You know, Patrice, I'm thinking about how celebratory the soufflé is. And I think it's a dish we've really lost sight of. So I'd love for you to walk us through the basics of making a soufflé.
Yes, of course. First of all, a soufflé might be kind of intimidated, but in fact, it's not very difficult. But you have to follow, you know, a few rules, of course. And the number one rule would be the egg whites. You can practically souffle anything you want. As long as you have those egg whites, perfect. Now, let me take you back inside those egg whites. What's going on when you whip those egg whites, either with a machine or by hand, with a whisk?
Right.
You are making small bubbles. And the key here is those bubbles trapping the air. And if you whisk them too fast, you're making a larger bubble. Therefore, the wall of those bubbles are getting thinner. So when you put your souffle in the oven and the air, you know, as it warms up, expands, the bubble collapses and the souffle goes down.
Ah.
That's the big secret in here. So what you want to do is, first of all, have those egg whites at room temperature before you whisk them. And you don't want to whisk it too fast. Therefore, you create more bubbles, but smaller bubbles with a thicker wall. So when you place your souffle in the oven, what happens? The air expands and the souffle stay nice and fluffy.
So you're saying you would, if you're using a mixer, you would be beating them at about medium speed?
Correct.
All right, but let's go, I want to go even further backwards because adding the egg whites is the last step of making a souffle. But what are the basic components of the souffle?
First of all, we have to say that we have a different kind of souffle. Huh? We have the sweet souffle. The savory souffle, also like cheese souffle.
Right.
You can make also frozen souffle.
Right.
And then you have the fruit souffle. But in all those souffle, what we have in common is a structure of egg yolk and flour.
Okay.
Those are the basic for our souffle structure.
So it's essentially almost like making a cream sauce, you know, a bechamel in the sense, but enriching it with egg yolks?
Correct. In fact, if you're making a bechamel with cheese and egg yolk, and you incorporate those egg whites, you have a cheese souffle. Now, of course, cooking them in the oven, it's also, you know, a very delicate operation. Now, one thing, there's a saying in the kitchen, the souffle don't wait for the customer, but the customer wait for the souffle.
Aha, yeah.
What does that mean? It means when the souffle is ready, it's got to go. So you make sure then your guests, whoever you're serving the souffle for, are ready to wait a little bit for the souffle. And when the souffle comes out of the oven, immediately, of course, we serve it. Now, going back in the oven, of course, temperature is a big thing. You have to make sure, depending which one you're working with, the sweet or the savory, you're going to be in the range of temperature between 375 to 400 degrees, because we need good heat to boost the heat inside the souffle mold and have those bubbles expand.
Right.
But also the mold that you make your souffle with, also very important.
The mold, you mean the dish that you put it in?
The dish you put them in, yeah. If you look at the market, they have what they call souffle mold, which is a kind of a ramekin, which is about 5 inches across.
Right.
And that's also important because of the ratio of souffle batter that you have in the ramekin and the bowl when you cook it. If you have an extremely large a mold and you try to cook the souffle, what's going to happen is going to overcook on the outside and be certainly uncooked on the inside. So those souffle mold, which is about 5 inches across and probably 3 inches tall, are perfect size for souffle.
Well, you know, Patrice, I think we actually can get this down now. So we're talking a custard or a white sauce, which is also known as a bechamel, of flavoring, beat the egg whites, fold them in. Oven should be, what did you say?
375 to 400 degrees.
Okay. All right. And when it's puffed up, get it out of there and get
yes.
it to the table.
And to give you one more point on those egg whites, do not overbeat them. Because what happens when you overbeat egg whites, like I was talking about those bubbles, they are getting bigger. But also the natural water from the egg whites comes out. So put a little bit of acid, either a squeeze of a little bit of lemon juice or creme of tartar. And that would retard the water from those egg whites to come out.
Ah, so it strengthens the structure.
Yes.
Chef Patrice, thank you very much.
Lynn, you're welcome. And thank you again for having me on the show.
Chef Patrice Olivon is Program Director of Culinary Arts at L'Académie de Cuisine in Maryland. Now, you can find his cheese soufflé recipe on the website, splendidtable.org. I've got another basic for you. Making a pot of good, hot, sturdy broth from what you've got in the vegetable bin. No meat, and it's not going to be missed. The way you give any broth real oomph and character is by browning the ingredients before they go in the water. Now, with vegetable broth, you do it in a big, wide skillet with the usual suspects, celery, carrot, onion, and some mushrooms. Now, once they're brown, they go into a deep pot with water and garlic and herbs. And to open up all their flavors, you use the umami trick. You add wine and a little tomato, which are loaded with umami. Now, this is the protein that improves the tastes of everything it comes in contact with. Now, one lovely thing to do with homemade broth is, instead of greeting guests on a cold night with a cold drink, have cups of the hot broth. And you can make it Italian by adding a few spoons of red wine and a sprinkle of Parmigiano. Okay, get my recipe for hearty vegetable broth on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, wine smarts for the baffled and the perplexed, and the heart of Indian cooking from a box. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Why is it that we intelligent adults face a wine list in a restaurant or a wine shelf in a shop and we're flummoxed? I mean, flummoxed mostly by the folderol around wine. And don't get me wrong, wine is a profound subject. It's worthy of a lifetime of study. But for those of us who have scheduled other things for our lifetimes, how do we stop being confused? Well, to start, consider this quote. The point of learning about wine is not to know everything about wine. The point of learning about wine is to enjoy life more. Well, it's from a refreshingly practical book called Drink This, Wine Made Simple. It's by food and wine critic Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl. Dara, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so if wine is about enjoying life more, then it's got to be about what we like. That's logical, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how do we figure out what kind of wine we like?
The way I have my book laid out is that I just basically took the 9 most popular varietals. And what are varietals? They're, you know, the way we have, you know, apples, you have your Granny Smith, you have your Red Delicious. The apples look very different. You know, those are different varietals
right.
of apples. When wines, you know, the Chardonnay, the Zinfandel, all those different grapes, they're like apples. They all have their own look and their own flavor and their own taste. So in these different varietals of wines, like Zinfandel, there's really only about 5 different sort of different flavors of it, so to speak. You know, mm-hmm. there's a sweet and uncomplicated one that's inexpensive. And then there's a more complicated one that's a little more expensive. And then there's a very highly regarded, critically acclaimed one, which is very plush and opulent and all that stuff. And you can actually taste the 5 styles of Zinfandel quite easily over the next 2 months. And if you can taste sort of 2 wines at the same time, you know, one more complicated, one less complicated, sort of right next to each other, you will know exactly what you think. You think, oh, I like this, or no, I don't like that. And you will narrow down the entire universe of that kind of wine mm-hmm. immediately. And then if you try a couple more over the next few months, you will be an expert. You will know more than anyone save, you know, people in the industry.
Okay, so let's use the Zinfandel as the example.
Okay.
What should I start with? I'm going to go out and I'm going to buy, if not 5, let's say 3 Zinfandels to start with.
Well, I would start with sort of your bottom shelf ones. The bottom shelf wines are the less expensive, you know, the under $12. So you want to know what the sort of average taste of a Zinfandel is, something that's harvested by machines and made in big tanks and is just sort mm-hmm. of a lot of different fields blended together. And so that could be, you know, Rancho Zabaco or Klein or any of the sort of big names of Zinfandel. Then I would find a single vineyard. And what does that mean? That's kind of, you know, if you're familiar with buying things from a farm, you know, you get your Pastures of Plenty pork or your, you know, it's from
right.
a single farm, essentially. And so that's your single vineyard Zinfandel. It all comes from the same exact place. It will express something specific about, you know, the levels of whatever in the soil and mm-hmm. how much sunlight it gets and this and the other thing. And those will typically be more, you know, brambly and less fruit and more French style as we kind of think of them in America.
Maybe more complex.
Yeah, and maybe just more subtle. And mm-hmm. then there's something, there's a sort of benchmark American wine place called Turley Cellars, and they make the most critically well-regarded Zinfandel in the world, and it's lush and it's opulent and this and the other thing. And some people hate it, but some people love it to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you go into just about any good wine shop in the country and say, I would like a Turley Zinfandel, very few places will actually have it, but they'll always kind of put something in your hands that's similar. And so then you've got your, you know, your one site-specific one, your bottom shelf one, your, you know, super opulent, critically well-regarded one. And if you taste those 3 wines, you know, sort of next to each other or, you know, in the course of the same evening, and you will very quickly know, you know, some people will taste them and say, oh, you know what? The bottom shelf one is a lot like the best one in the world, and it's good enough for me and my money. And then you're done. You know, you can mm-hmm, now have mm-hmm. a Zinfandel you like forever. And other people will taste the single vineyard one and go, oh, I'm kind of chasing interesting flavors and it's subtle and I'm just having a really great experience. And then they know that they like the single vineyard ones. And they don't have to be expensive. Those wines could be $18 to $30 typically. Mm-hmm. And then other people might taste the, you know, the Turley Cellars one and just be like, oh, my God, it's like I've been hit by a lightning bolt. It's the happiest I've ever been in my life. You know, and then you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you know that about yourself. But once you've sort of tasted those 3 things, you know what it tastes like to you. You know, and that, I think, is everything. Because there isn't. In wine, there's this idea that there's, you know, the perfect one, it's the greatest one, and if you're classy and if you really knew anything, you'd like the critically well-regarded one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not. I don't think it's like that at all. You know, if you think about it, maybe like apples. You know, it might be that one of them is like a raw apple, and one of them is like an apple pie, and the third one is like an, you know, apple in the hands of Jean-Georges Vongerichten, and it's all in a, you know, cannoli with yuzu powder or something. And maybe you don't want the crazy apple cannoli with yuzu powder. Maybe
you want a straight
apple.
Like
an apple. And there's nothing wrong with that. And when you try them, then you know and you can feel good about that.
Dara, thank you.
Thank you.
Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl is author of Drink This, Wine Made Simple. Now you can get her tasting suggestions on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, right up there with understanding wine is understanding the cooking of India. Now, we're talking another lifetime pursuit here. This is one of the most complicated cuisines that I can think of. Food writer Monica Bidet is an engineer by training, so distilling Indian cooking down to what is truly essential maybe comes naturally to her. Monica's done a book. It's called Modern Spice, Inspired Indian Flavors for the Contemporary Kitchen. Monica, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, I want to talk to you about spices. What would be sort of the starter pack, so to speak, or points for someone who's beginning to use spices and wants to take on Indian food?
Absolutely. I think the top starter pack, as you say, would be cumin, coriander, turmeric, cayenne, mustard seeds, that's the little brown seeds, and salt. I mean, that's all you really need. If you have these, you really don't need a whole bunch of other stuff.
Boy, when you think about the list of things you see in recipes, that really does boil it down, doesn't it? But, you know, the other thing is, and you talk about this in your writings, there are boxes you can buy of spice blends, and I see them in stores, you know, international markets and that kind of thing. Are these any good?
Absolutely. And after I've said that, I'll decide which table I'm going to hide under. But, you know, these spice boxes are really good. You know, years ago when I moved here, we didn't have these choices. But now you see these blends being used by chefs in very prominent restaurant kitchens. And a classic example of a box spice that's fabulous is chaat masala, which literally means licking spice. It's C-H-A-A-T masala. You can make this at home. Absolutely. Buy the 15 spices needed. You know, play around, tinker around with it till you get your taste. Mm-hmm. Or spend about 99 cents and buy Sean's absolutely fabulous chaat masala. I mean, there are things that I wouldn't buy prepackaged. And I'll give you a perfect example for that is garam masala. Because it uses like 3 or 4 spices. I know exactly how to put it together. I learned it from my mom. I make it at home. But chaat masala, tandoori masala, they're fabulous to go and buy.
Now, you mentioned a brand called Sean. Are there other brands as well to look for?
Yes, MDH is a very good brand.
So, Monica, how do you use chaat masala?
Well, we are officially a family of addicts when it comes to chaat masala. When I was a child, you know, my mother would sprinkle it on like pan sauteed paneer. She would sprinkle it on different types of fruits that she bought, you know, from guava to mango to apples to bananas. I got my sons addicted to it, and the older one loves to sprinkle it on his French fries. He puts it on steamed crab. He puts it on shrimp. I mean, it's almost like a tangy salt. You know, so anything that needs a little bit of that tang and a little bit of salt, it's perfect on that. And the 2.5-year-old just likes to put it on his palm and lick it, so I guess to each his own.
Now, how about making our own spice blends?
Oh, my God. You know, this is wonderful. Once you start playing with spices and you know sort of how to put the flavors together, it's very easy to do this. One of my personal favorites is a spice mix that I make that's with fennel and red pepper. This is the cayenne, the dried red pepper, and peppercorns. You just dry roast them a little bit and then grind them up. This stuff is amazing. I make oven-roasted cauliflower with this blend, and I add a little bit of coriander for lemon because, for me, cauliflower is always associated with a little bit of lemony flavor growing up. And it just tastes fabulous. You don't have to do any of the work, so the spice blends do it for you. Incidentally, this blend also works really great with, like, fish. You can put it on fish and marinate the fish and put it in the oven. Tastes fabulous.
So it's fennel, black peppercorns, and hot cayenne pepper.
That's it.
And you toast it in a skillet until it's what? Smells good?
Until it smells good. Yeah, just watch it because, you know, spices are unforgiving if you leave them on the heat too long and there's no way to rescue them. So just, you know, a moderate heat, just start stirring them on a dry skillet until you can really smell the fragrance. And as soon as you smell it, turn it off and take it away from the heat. Put it in a different pan to allow it to cool down.
Right.
You don't want it sitting in the hot pan.
Right.
And then just grind it. And like, you know, if you have a small spice grinder, that's great. If you have a small coffee grinder that you're not using to make coffee, then that's great. Or a mortar and pestle if you don't mind some elbow grease.
And how long will it keep?
As long as you can smell it, it's alive and it'll work beautifully for you. I would say, you know, 6 months to a year. But if you open the spice mix and put it up to your nose and you can't smell it, it's dead. I would say don't use it.
Monica, thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Monica's book is Modern Spice, Inspired Indian Flavors for the Contemporary Kitchen. Now, you can find her roasted cauliflower with fennel recipe right on the website, splendidtable.org. Food has been welcomed at last in the academic world of social history. Now consider this topic, crime and nourishment. Now this has to be one of the catchier titles for a doctoral dissertation. And by the way, the subtitle is The Food and Foodways of Hollywood Gangster Films. Its creator, Rebecca Epstein, now is a doctor of philosophy in film and television. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you.
Rebecca, I'm just thinking about all the ways that food plays in film. You never think of food in gangster films. I mean, why gangster films?
Well, it's interesting when I often hear that. And when you think about it for a minute, suddenly scenes start coming to mind, particularly with Italian mafia films. People do have those associations with food in film.
Yeah, that's right. I remember from very old movies, the James Cagney scene. I think it was a movie from the 30s, and he plays a gangster, and he shoves a half a grapefruit in the face of his girlfriend, and it still makes me squirm anytime I see it.
Yes, and you know that film, that scene was actually improvised, which is part of the reason she looks so shocked.
Right.
But it started for me, I actually took an informal poll in one of my graduate classes of the students in my class and asked them what, for them, were some of their most memorable food scenes in film. And to my surprise, about 80% of the class came back with scenes from Pulp Fiction.
Huh.
And now this was back in 95. That film came out in 93, so it wasn't too far away from that point.
Right.
But what I realized is that I hadn't thought about all those scenes. I knew the film began and ended at a diner, and I was as charmed as anybody by the Le Big Mac dialogue and all of that, but it hadn't occurred to me exactly how rich with food that film was. So I began by studying that film and looking at the different ways food was used, and then I started to think, well, what about in other gangster films? And so much had been written about the gangster film in film scholarship, but nobody had really written about the way food was used, both structurally and thematically. So that became my project.
I always think of food in a gangster movie. I mean, if you think about it, you think of it as sort of an aside, that it's not really important to the plot. So this is like putting on a different set of glasses to look at it.
Exactly. It's about bringing the background forward. And it actually speaks to a film in general. You know, we're used to thinking about the food film with food as the star of the
show.
Right,
right.
But in this case, my argument was you can't actually really understand this genre unless you look at the way food is used. And one of the things I found that was most profound structurally is that there's a constant alternation between food scenes and violent scenes. It's not in every single gangster film, but it's enough to feel like there's something going on here that's impacting the way that we are experiencing these films. There is a tension that is constantly being provoked within us in this constant alternation between food scenes where people are gathering together, eating, enjoying each other's company, and then, bam, somebody's dying. Hence all these murder scenes in restaurants and, you know, we're caught by surprise every time.
Some specific films that you think would really be interesting to look at through that prism.
Well, one of them is that film you mentioned, Public Enemy, starring James Cagney. You know, that's one of the main films in my study, because one thing that has been identified in the gangster film is the persistent imagery of misogyny. And as I began my study, I realized there are actually numerous gangster films where men are throwing food at women. So food becomes a way to express misogyny, which has already been identified as one of the elements of the gangster genre.
Right, right.
So that's one. Another one is Bonnie and Clyde, where I talk about food and sex. And in that film, Clyde is you know, known for his impotence. And one of the ways he sublimates that is through a constant, he just constantly eats dairy products. There's constant references to peaches and pies, and I'm sure I don't have to explain to your audience ways that those foods have come to represent, you know, certain parts of the female body.
Right.
At the same time, Bonnie is very much a masculine presence in that film, and she eats a lot of meat. She's constantly eating hamburgers, and there's just an interesting way of looking at these characters through the food that they eat.
This is pretty fascinating. Well, let's get specific about Pulp Fiction.
Well, one of the interesting things about that film is the men in that film are constantly eating the food that children tend to eat. They're eating Pop-Tarts, cereal. In one scene, these young men are eating hamburgers for breakfast. And you just get the sense that these are not grown-up men. These are men who are trying to find their way, and they're feeling their most comfortable eating foods that are familiar to them, but maybe not necessarily appropriate for their age or that time of day. Huh. And that's one of the things that also throws us off balance in that film. We never quite know what time it is because their food doesn't really sync up with the associations we have with what you eat at what meal.
And also the food that sounds like the food of innocence.
Absolutely.
Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Epstein is Doctor of Philosophy in Film and Television. Her dissertation was Crime and Nourishment, The Food and Foodways of Hollywood Gangster Films. Well, okay, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, how did the ancient Greeks cure a hangover? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be talking to you. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252. See us at Facebook. Get online. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how did the ancient Greeks cure a hangover? Well, there were a number of choices. Overboiled cabbage, which literally cleared the problem. Fried canaries, if you can imagine. Eels drowned in red wine, probably achieved the same thing as the cabbage. Or raw owl eggs with a side of sheep lungs, which no doubt achieve the same thing as the cabbage, only faster. Just think of those sheep lungs when your pals chirp, "Hey, how about opening another bottle?"
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It is time for us to talk. We're opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Anything goes. Okay, let's see who is up. We've got Michael on the phone calling from Phoenix. Michael, what do you want to talk about?
Oh, Lynn, I've got something I'm a little bit embarrassed about. I want to talk about sharpening knives.
Oh, Michael, I feel for you. No, seriously, why embarrassing?
Well, I've got a drawer full of Dahl knives. And I have to tell you, like a lot of your listeners, I know my way around a kitchen, but
right.
This is one area that I just don't know what to do.
Well, can I make a confession?
Yes.
It's not out of not knowing what to do. It's the laziness. My knives at times are embarrassing. And, you know, people come in to, you know, and everybody joins in cooking. And suddenly you want to hang your head because your knives are dull. But I, you know, do what I say and not what I do. So what do you want? You want to know how to sharpen your knives?
Well, I want to know, do I sharpen my knives? And if so, what should I purchase? And if I'm not purchasing something, do I just take them someplace to get sharpened?
Well, do you have a steel? You know, one of those long things?
I do have a steel.
Okay, because that's used to kind of reset the edge of the knife from one time to the next when you're using the knives, when you're working with your knives. But to sharpen the knife, to really reset that edge and get the knife sharp, which you don't do every day, either it's done professionally, and the reason I'm hesitant about saying send them away or give them to someone is that unless they really know what they're doing, they can ruin your knives. We used to have a source that we really liked, but then they went through some changes as a company. So right now I cannot reliably offer you a place to send them. But I can tell you the basic idea of how you do it at home.
Okay.
You can get yourself a stone. It's usually rectangular. One side is usually rougher. Another side is very smooth. And what you do is you put that stone on a damp towel so that it doesn't slide around on a counter. You take your knife, and most knives are honed to be around a 20-degree angle, meaning that you'll slide the blade over that stone from the base of the blade to the tip. So it's like you're making an arc over the stone, but you're trying to maintain that knife at a 20-degree angle to the stone. Some people say if you stack up a bunch of quarters, I think it's 8 or 9 quarters, that's how you do it. I remember, this is what I always do. When my knife is put down where the blade is just right on the stone, you know, sticking up straight,
yes,
that's 90 degrees. If I bend it halfway to be flat on the stone, that's 45 degrees. If I go a little more than halfway down on that, that's 20 degrees. So you see what I'm doing?
Yeah.
And I just gently slide that knife at that angle across. Then I turn it around and I slide it back the other way. And you start out with the rougher side. Just do that maybe 5 or 6 times. Then you go to the finer side.
Now, am I going from the base to the tip?
Yes. And don't press hard. The weight of the knife and the stone will do the work.
And hopefully it's sharp.
Yes. Yes. And you can do that. Now, when you're using your knives a lot, some people do it once a week. But then you want to use your steel, that long rod that you have, on a day-to-day basis to just give it, and again, the same 20-degree angle. You can just take the knife all the way down the length of that rod.
Now, there's also different kinds of steels. One steel that I have is just sort of metal.
Right.
Another one has a rougher finish, almost a diamond finish.
You don't want super rough.
Okay,
you
well.
Want it a little teeny bit rough, but really something that when you rub your hand over it, you're not getting snagged or anything like that.
Lynn, thank you very much.
And by the way, there is a book on knives that has a dissertation on sharpening that you can read for about 10 pages worth, and it's called An Edge in the Kitchen.
Oh, perfect.
All right.
Dynamite
book. Hey, thank you.
Excellent.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Complicated subject, sharpening knives. But you can call us, 800-537-5252, or go online, splendidtable.org. Let's see. We've got Pamela calling from Fort Lauderdale. Pamela, what do you want to talk about?
Well, pomegranates, actually.
Oh, okay.
I just thought I'd call because I don't think I've ever eaten a pomegranate.
Oh.
And they're intriguing and they're beautiful. And well, there's two things. Number one, I don't know. I would never know how to pick one out.
Right.
And number two, I've seen them cut open, and I don't know what you do with them. I don't know if you eat the seeds or the.
It's a very good question because when you look inside of a pomegranate, you're kind of sitting there saying, "This is utterly beautiful."
Yes.
But what am I supposed to do with it?
Exactly.
Yeah, well. You know, I love the romance of the pomegranate because it's always been a sign of fertility and plenty. And the color is the most exquisite shade of red. I mean, it's just incredible. So, all right, buying a pomegranate. You want to handle it. It shouldn't have any soft spots. It shouldn't look shrunken because a pomegranate has sections, sort of like an oversized orange in the sense that there may be 8 sections or 6 sections.
Oh.
To the whole fruit. And if you see a sign of those sections, you know, if it looks like it's drying and it's sinking into itself, you don't want to go near that baby. You want it to be plump.
Oh.
When you hold it in your hand and gently press it, you don't want to feel any real softness or squishiness.
Okay.
Okay? And it should have just an appealing look to it. You know, it should look plump. It should look, I want to say contented, but it should look like a fruit that's just come off the tree. Now, the other thing is that the way it's used, first of all, the juice is exquisite. The juice is so delicious because it's tart and sweet and fruity all at the same time, very complex in flavor. And you can buy pure pomegranate juice just on its own. But the other thing you do when you have a whole pomegranate is you do eat the seeds. So what you would do is you'd cut it in quarters or in sixths, okay? And then what you can do over a bowl, because the seeds are embedded in sort of a membrane, you can easily just pop out the seeds into a bowl.
Okay.
And now some people crush those seeds so that that gel that's around the seeds yields all of its juice, and then they just press it in a sieve and they use the juice. But others of us just sprinkle those seeds on salads, eat the seeds straight, or suck on each seed to get the gel off, and then gracefully dispose of them into a napkin.
So you can eat everything except the membrane.
That's right. That's right. And the membrane won't do you any harm. It's just not very tasty.
Right.
So that's and by the way, in India, those seeds are sold dried. And they're used, they're either crushed or they're sprinkled into dishes. They show up in a lot of the Mediterranean and places like India. And it's a good place to go for how to use it.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thank you for a great question.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. Call us, 800-537-5252. It's such a beautiful fruit, and winter is when it's in season. We got a voicemail from Rob in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Now, he wanted to know, what are some substitutes for red and white wine, other alcohols like rum and brandy, etc., in cooking? He wants to keep the umami factor that the alcohol has, but he doesn't want to use alcohol, is what I'm gathering. Now, the umami is the idea that there are certain foods that contain a substance that heightens all the flavors that you mix with that food. So you could use dark mushrooms, okay? You could use a few drops of fish sauce, Asian fish sauce. You wouldn't taste it in the dish, but it has a lot of umami in it. Tomato paste, soy sauce. Those are the things that you could use that I'm thinking are readily available. You can get anywhere. And each one of those, although they have a different flavor, should work kind of with almost any kind of recipe. So if you don't want to use alcohol, but you want to heighten flavors, it's never going to taste the same. But think dark mushrooms, a few drops of fish sauce, soy sauce, or tomato paste. And Rob, thanks for a great question. You can reach us at the website, splendidtable.org, or you can call 24/7, 800-537-5252. We've got Tom calling from Arlington, Virginia. Hey, Tom, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, thanks for taking my call.
You are welcome, sir.
I am, for the past year, I've been brewing my own beer.
Oh, I love it.
And, yeah. And actually, for the first time, my wife likes to drink beer with me, too, which is great. And I know we get to talk about wine on the show a lot, but I thought that I have this a couple cases of this Belgian triple that I've brewed.
Oh, really?
And,
oh, boy.
You know,
that's a very rich-tasting beer, as I recall.
Yeah. A little sour,
yeah.
A lot of deep flavor. And,
right.
And I thought I'd call and see if you had some ideas on you know, like a meal we could put together with the beer and maybe even cook with the beer a little bit.
Very first thing that comes to mind is a Belgian recipe called carbonade, and it's done with beef or it's done with pork, where you brown the meat with a little bit of either salt pork, or you could even use a tad of bacon. And then you have onions and you have carrots and you've got celery and even some prune or apricot. And then you add the beer to the pan, and you boil that beer down to nothing, you know, maybe a cup of it.
Okay.
And then add a bit more and simmer that down a bit. Then you add some broth, enough to cover the meat, and you slowly braise the meat in that until it's tender. So you would use a pork shoulder, you would use beef chuck or beef shin, and you've got bits of the dried fruit. I love it with apricots.
Yeah, you know, I thought about asking you. I thought about making a like a cassoulet, but I'm kind of intimidated by that.
Don't know that a cassoulet is going to work as well with this, with the
okay.
beer. But I think the idea of a braised dish, or you serve the beer with something like a Great Virginia ham or a ham of any kind, because the beer will take brilliantly to pork.
Yeah.
Or, I know I keep talking about this, but a pork shoulder, and you baste that meat with the beer, and then you serve the beer with it, and the beer becomes a pan sauce, you see.
Okay.
And
yeah.
You could do that, and you could then you could, you know, you make, you can make, you just cut with a knife into the roast, and you can stuff it with a combination of fresh herbs, maybe something like fresh thyme with orange zest and garlic. And that works really beautifully with the flavors that you get from this kind of beer that's rich and tart, but it has a great deal of body to it. And then you keep basting that meat with that beer, and it's going to blend with the juices that end up in the pan, and it's going to be delicious.
That sounds fantastic.
I think that's a better way to go, and it's pretty, so festive looking to come out with a nice big hunk of, you know, of something that's that beautiful. It would, I think it would be fabulous. And the other thing you could do, too, is cook tiny onions in it with a bit of cream.
Okay.
You know, and make a side dish. And that might be too much beer, but still. And, of course, you'd serve the beer. You would serve the beer instead of wine. It would be perfect.
Yeah, that's the goal.
Yeah, so. I think this could make a really festive meal for you.
Well, I very much appreciate the advice. So.
Well, thank you, sir.
Bye.
You know, we don't think about beer with food, and we really should. Because, for instance, you take a beer that's very tart and very fresh, and you serve that instead of champagne because it acts the same way. You know, our wine guy, Josh Wesson, talks about this all the time, that champagne or bubbly wines are often the double for a really crisp, light beer. So think about that. This is what you always hear. It's the water. That's what people say separates the true New York bagel, which is small, chewy, and made, of course, with New York City water, from the big, squishy nebbishes called bagels in places west of the Hudson River. Well, a man named Steve Fassberg has taken this water thing very seriously. He created the original Brooklyn Bagel Company in Delray Beach, Florida. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
So what have you actually done?
Well, I wish I could say I was the guy that actually created the patents. That was done by an actual chemical water engineer who has solved the water treatment problems of over 35 countries that were much more significant than getting a good quality bagel.
Mm-hmm.
And we've taken that technology that's presently used in the loo for humidifiers. It's used for chemical reagents and laboratories for pharmaceutical companies. It was used for high-speed lasers that actually can cut steel, but it was never used in a bakery laboratory setting. So what we've done is we've been able to get the exclusive right to this technology and add a couple of components that can recreate perfect Brooklyn, New York water, which is perfect for ice cubes that we use in the store, for coffee, for soup, for anything that goes on in the restaurant, because 80% of any menu, as we know, begins with the water. But for the baking process, we then have identified the actual mineral content of Brooklyn, New York water, and from there identified the key mineral ingredients that were necessary for baking, eliminating all the harmful things like lead and chlorine and ammonia, and then adding back in parts per millionth the actual mineral content, cooling it to the right temperature, and then having a computer that oversees it so that you have the scalable water solution for any place in the world to make a perfect Brooklyn, New York bagel.
All right, now wait, though. Mm-hmm. I know the water is really important, but the bastardization of the classic bagel is, I think a lot more has happened to it than the water.
You're true. Well, with bagels, 50% of that recipe, in most cases, is water. So before you even thought about boiling the product,
right.
50% of your actual recipe is made up of water and 50% of, let's say, conditioners and flour and salt and whatnot.
Right.
So if you're not starting with good ingredients like any good baker or any good cook knows, you're not going to get a good result. And of course, understanding that it is about the water, it was an old wives' tale. Quite frankly, I was very committed to proving it, but I wasn't sure really that it could be done. And,
right.
And even the gentleman who created the water technology, who's been all over the globe, is a guy from Kentucky who happens to be of a Jewish background, and he simply said, no one cares about a bagel. A bagel's a bagel. It's about location, and you know, I don't think the water has anything to do with it. And this was coming from the guy who actually invented the water treatment that solved this problem. So I had a big hurdle, especially from the people who helped me with the technology, to understand the value of this product and the acceptance that it was already waiting out there for it, because people are so passionate about bagels. Quite frankly, it's taken me by surprise. I mean, I'm ecstatic that people have responded the way they have.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't done any advertising, and we're having trouble keeping up with production of that product. And quite frankly, we've had aficionados from all over the country tell us that they have never seen anything quite like it, which we're extremely ecstatic about.
Well, Steve, I wish you very good luck. Thank you so much.
It was absolutely my pleasure. You guys have a wonderful week.
Steve Fastberg is creator of the original Brooklyn Bagel Company in Delray Beach, Florida. Well, that's the show this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime, 800-537-5252, or check us out on Facebook or send us a tweet. You have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Beatrice and Ira Freeman. They said, "The bagel is an unsweetened donut with rigor mortis." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear and Roger Miller. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. You have a good week, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.